This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
This is the 25th year that charter schools have been operating in the U.S., and a new report says that enrollment-wise, they're doing better than ever. Hundreds of new charter schools have opened this year. However, a couple of hundred have also closed, and the head of a national charter school group says that's fine with them.
There's no perfect formula on how to do this, but we think that so long as the authorizers are swiftly closing poor-performing schools, they're putting the movement on the right track.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll catch up with the charter school movement. Then we'll hear the second story in our series on Common Core in the South and hear how officials are trying to calm the controversy over the standards. And we'll also spend an academic minute looking at the sunny side of E. coli bacteria. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. According to a new report released this month by the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, enrollment in charter public schools has grown by 250,000 students in the 2015-16 school year. The report is called A Closer Look at the Charter School Movement, Schools, Students, and Management Organizations 2015-16. It estimates that the total number of students currently attending charter public schools is about 3 million, representing a six-fold increase in charter school enrollment over the past 15 years. Here to talk about this report and the charter school movement in general is Nina Reese. She's president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. We spoke a few days after the report was released, and I asked her to talk about the findings.
Yes. So every year, the National Alliance publishes a report that tracks the growth of charter schools across the country. We noticed last year, this coming school year, 400 new charter schools opened, serving an additional 250,000 students, which is about a 9% growth in the sector. So we're extremely optimistic about the growth, and this has been a consistent growth over the years. So right now, we're at 6,800 public charter schools around the country, serving close to 3 million students.
And we should point out, too, that there were significant closings, so it was a net growth of 132 schools, right?
Yes, yes. So, and that's actually a pretty important point because charter schools are held accountable by authorizers. The terms of the charter require that the authorizer close them if they're not meeting up to the standards that have been set or if they don't have enough families who are interested in attending the school. We measure our success actually not only based on how many schools have opened, but also in how many have closed in those areas where the quality of the marketplace is not high. So the fact that we have had 271 schools close last year is a welcome sign.
And why would a school close?
There are a variety of reasons. By and large, it could be, as I said, fiscal reasons. As you know, charter schools are open enrollment schools, and if a family is not interested in sending their child to that school, they will not be able to keep their doors open. They can only operate based on the budget that they're bringing in, based on the number of students that they're attracting. So one factor is always on the fiscal side. You have to have enough money to run your school, and if you don't have enough families attracted to you or your program, you're not able to sustain the school. Another reason is just, to the extent the entity overseeing the charter school has any concerns with the quality of the school and the oversight of the school from a financial standpoint, they have the authority to close that school. So in some instances, it is a question of, whether they are, performing well academically. Increasingly, though, we want to see more schools close because of academics. And one of the focuses that our organization and the National Association of Charter School Authorizers has brought to the forefront is this focus on quality. So in an ideal setting, you want to have as few closures as possible because you want the authorizers to only open high-quality schools. But when you do that, you also narrow the pool of applicants who are getting in. And so, there's no perfect formula on how to do this, but we think that so long as the authorizers are swiftly closing poor-performing schools, they're putting the movement on the right track.
Let's talk right now about the three types of organizations that run charter schools. Could you go through that for us, starting with the independents?
Yes. So there, by and large, there are three different types of charter schools currently operating around the country. Charter schools that are operated by one individual. We consider them, schools that are run by single site operators. These are usually a group of teachers or community leaders have come together to start a school, and they only want to run that school. They're not interested in scaling or going beyond one campus, so to speak. So that's one type of school, and right now we have 68% of the schools in our movement are comprised of single-site operators. 20% of them are operated by what we consider or call charter management organizations. These are organizations like KIPP, Success Academies, IDEA, Yes Prep. I don't know if these names ring a bell, but these are organizations or schools that started with one campus, but they have been able to fine-tune their model and replicate the model in multiple locations. And so they've been able to grow, and the size is actually fairly small. Most of these charter management organizations have about 10 to 20 campuses. KIPP, which I mentioned earlier, has about 144 schools right now. The third category are EMOs, or schools that are run by education management organizations or for-profit organizations. 12% of our schools, of the schools in the market right now, are operated by EMOs.
What would you say is the biggest misperception about charter schools that, from your point of view, around the country?
Well, polls usually indicate large public support for charter schools. Every year, the Phi Delta Kappa polls public attitudes toward different issues in the education space, and what people think about charter schools is one of the questions that they ask. So consistently, over 60% of the public say that they like charter schools, but at the same time, a good portion of the public doesn't know a lot about what a charter school is and how it operates. So the fact that they are, in fact, public is one of the misconceptions out there about charter schools. In terms of what the opposition is propagating, some of the misconceptions are also around the public nature of the enterprise, but to them, the corporate takeover of our schools is one of the myths that they talk quite a bit about. But if you look at the data, as I just mentioned earlier, 68% of our schools are run by an individual or one community organization or group. So most of them are not operated by an organization like a charter management or an education management organization. And I would think that talking a little bit more about who is running these schools and how they're serving the needs of the community and closing the achievement gap is extremely important.
Well, I asked you before why a charter school would close. Why would a charter school open? Why do they open in certain parts of the country?
Oh, well, for a variety of reasons. Just as a frame of reference, we've now had charter schools for 25 years. The first charter school law passed in Minnesota 25 years ago, and this is the 25th anniversary of the movement, so to speak. And every state after that started or enacted a charter school law for a very different reason. In some regions, charter schools were created as a direct response to the need of low-income families who wanted access to more options. And in some instances, there were movements afoot to allow those families to attend private schools that were not going very far. So charter schools were a mechanism to meet these families halfway by offering them options, but continuing to give those options within the public realm. In other places, the law was passed simply because they, the lawmakers and leaders wanted to give teachers more authority over how their school was managed, give them more autonomy to come up with different pedagogies and to innovate in their schools. So depending again on when the laws were passed, they were either centered around giving families more choices or centered around closing the achievement gap or raising the achievement of low-income students or to give the local community greater say in how their schools, their school was operating.
Where has the biggest growth in charter schools come in the past few years?
So that's a great question. Arizona has had the largest growth in charter schools, and it's they were one of the first adopters, and they've continued to grow their movements, over the years. California, of course, because of its size, has had the largest growth in the number of charter schools. Texas, Florida, Arizona, those are the states that have seen the largest growth. But again, because they're so large, you would expect these states to have a large percentage of their students in charter schools.
There are charter schools now in 41 states. You've got 9 to go.
Well, we actually have laws in 43 states and in Washington, D.C. It's just that in 2 of those states, we haven't been able to start a charter school yet. So, we have 7 laggards left.
Could you tell us a bit about the state of Louisiana? Because I understand charter schools are pretty important in that state.
Yes. So, as you know, Louisiana, after Hurricane Katrina, unfortunately hit the city of New Orleans, decided to use a mechanism that they had put in place to overtake their poorest performing schools to run the entire school system. So they hit what we consider to be the reset button, and they decided to rely on chartering as a mechanism to relaunch all of their schools, which means that every school was operated independently by an individual or a community leader or an educator who fully owned the school's progress and its management. After 10 years of having this system, this all-charter system in place, the results have been extremely positive. The gap in achievement between the students in New Orleans and the rest of the state has nearly disappeared, shrinking from about 23 points to just 6 points. The overall achievement of low-income students and African-American students has nearly doubled over the past 10 years, and graduation rates have also risen from somewhere in the 50% range to over 70%. So, the results out of New Orleans and Louisiana have been extremely positive, and we feel that they should definitely offer a roadmap to others who are interested in using chartering, not only as a mechanism to give some people the autonomy to open a school, but also as a school-wide reform that can entirely change the fabric of a school district and how it functions. And we've had examples of other places using the New Orleans model or the recovery district model in Tennessee and Michigan. Nevada just passed the law. So in these instances, the state is simply taking over the poorest performing school and using outside management or charter organizations to operate those schools. In an ideal setting, you want to change or offer chartering as a mechanism to overhaul the entire system and give the autonomy that comes with chartering to every principal in a district. And that, for us, is a better mechanism to see the power of chartering and to make sure that everyone in a community is actually partnering to raise student achievement.
I saw recently, in fact, it was just this week, that New York State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Illia showed up at a charter school rally, and that created a little bit of a controversy in the state. Could you talk about that for a moment?
Yes. We always welcome having elected officials at charter school rallies. And so in general, school district officials tend not to be friends of charter schools because they see them as a threat to the establishment. But we've also seen a good number of school district officials who have partnered with charter schools and treated them as part of the fabric of the public education system. So by and large, our hope is to find ways to partner with school districts and school district officials and find ways to collaborate and share our learning rather than to have them oppose what we do.
And finally, the question I ask everybody, what didn't I ask you that I really should have? What do you want everyone to know about charter schools?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about our movement is the more charter schools we open, the more students attend our schools. That leads to a greater number of students on wait lists to attend charter schools. So in this respect, the more choice begets additional choices, so to speak. And we feel strongly that continuing the growth of the movement through additional funding to launch these schools and to replicate and expand them is extremely important. But at the same time, you have to have a local climate that's open and inviting to charter schools and leaders who are interested in actually launching these schools. So all of these things have to happen in tandem for our movement to grow. But, again, having so many students attend charter schools is a great testament to the power of our movement. But so long as we have over 1 million student names on charter school wait lists, we haven't made that much progress.
Nina Reese is the president and CEO of the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. And you can find more on this report at public.com. charters.org. Still to come, educators and administrators are trying a lot of different ways to make Common Core a bit more popular in the South. Part two of our series is next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Common Core education standards have been controversial since their adoption nearly half a decade ago. Some states have tried rebranding Common Core by changing the name. Others have dropped the standards altogether. In the South, states are taking a different approach by asking residents themselves to reevaluate the standards. In the second of three stories examining Common Core education standards in the South, Mississippi Public Broadcasting's Paul Boger reports on how states are trying to make Common Core more attractive.
Anna Davis of Picayune and her daughter Isabel are using a workbook to learn about indexes and how to use them.
Can you read me the directions?
An index is a helpful reference that you should learn.
Isabel started kindergarten as a public school student, but when the Mississippi Board of Education adopted Common Core standards 5 years ago, she began homeschooling.
She's an advanced student, and so at home she gets individualized attention.
Davis says she doesn't like how the standards have changed public education.
It's the way, the approach that they take to teaching. You can't just shove everybody into one classroom and say, this is how we're going to do it, because the remedial students, the ones that need more attention and need more help, are going to set the pace for the class.
Teaching to the lowest common denominator, inappropriate subject matter, and data mining are just some of the complaints parents have made against Common Core. The controversy has even spilled over into the Mississippi Capitol. Since 2010, lawmakers have introduced a number of bills designed to repeal the standards, but none have succeeded. This year, lawmakers took a different approach by drafting Senate Bill 2161, which would have created a task force to review the standards and make recommendations on how to make them, quote, appropriate for Mississippi schools. Republican Gray Tolleson of Oxford is the chair of the Senate Education Committee and helped usher the measure through the legislature.
Let's let educators who are experts in standards and not legislators who are not expert in standards make these decisions. Just like a surgeon, I want a good heart surgeon that's board certified to operate on my heart, not some, you know, other person that's not board certified heart surgeon.
The measure ultimately died when it was vetoed by Mississippi's Republican governor because it didn't do enough to remove Common Core from the state's public schools. Education officials, however, are moving forward with a review of the state's standards. But instead of a task force, Superintendent of Education Kerry Wright says that the state is looking to average Mississippians for help.
And I think that knowing the level of scrutiny, obviously, our standards are under, we thought, you know what, we're going to put it out there for everybody to comment on. Because I think that this continual discontent that I hear, I think we need to really see what all Mississippians have to say about this and then provide that recommendation to our board members.
The review is part of an effort to garner support for the standards, while at the same time educating individuals on what is actually in them. State officials have also taken the rebranding approach. Common Core is now Mississippi's college and career readiness standards. Rebranding and public comment periods have been common in the South. Alabama, Florida, Kentucky, and Tennessee have all taken the same approach. But has it worked? Tennessee just recently closed their public comment period. Teresa Wasson is with the State Collaborative on Reforming Education, or SCORE, a group that has supported Common Core implementation in Tennessee. Wasson says the comments seem to be overwhelmingly in favor of the standards.
I think it is hard to say at this point whether minds have been changed. It certainly has. The review process was well received across the state. A lot of people thought that that was a good idea. The review that Tennessee has in place could lead to standards that are just as high or higher, and we very firmly believe that that's what students need.
Alabama also opened a public comment period late last year. Superintendent of Education Tommy Bice believes most people are beginning to come around to the standards.
Those that really do want to understand and get in-depth understanding of what standards are and the difference between standards and curriculum, those folks are coming around to see the value of this.
Parents like Anna Davis are supportive of Mississippi's public comment period, even though she says she's likely to continue homeschooling Isabel until she's ready for college.
I think that would be wonderful for the state, and I think that that would clear up a lot of problems that the state has with the school and other concerned parents. Personally, I don't think my child will go back to public school.
But homeschooling is still a rarity in Mississippi. 90% of the state's children attend public school, and parents like Tracy Klein of Pearl feel the standards serve a purpose.
I think of Common Core as a foundation. The schools that aren't performing up to that baseline, they need to come up. You don't have to stay there, but you at least need to be there.
In the end, it's not clear if states like Mississippi will continue to use Common Core, but it is highly likely that those new college and career readiness standards will look very familiar. For the Southern Education Desk, I'm Paul Boger in Jackson, Mississippi.
Our series on Common Core in the South is supported by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, let's see. So far today, we've talked about charter schools and Common Core. I think that's enough hate mail for one day. How about we expound on the sunny side of E. coli bacteria? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
E. coli bacteria may someday save human lives. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Blaine Pfeiffer, Associate Professor of Chemical and Biological Engineering at the University of Buffalo, explains why we should look beyond E. coli's bad reputation.
Few bacterial species have a reputation as ominous as E. coli. People associate the organism with danger and disease. News reports link it to cases of lethal food poisoning. But my research shows that there's a flip side to this story. While some strains of E. coli do make humans ill, most are harmless and easy to grow and manipulate. In our lab, we used one of these safe strains to produce new forms of antibiotics that could one day save human lives. Our colonies of E. coli make an antibiotic called urethromycin, which includes three novel forms of the drug that kill bacteria resistant to other drugs. This achievement is the culmination of more than a decade of research. In its natural state, E. coli does not make urethromycin. So the first thing we did was engineer the bacteria to produce the chemicals needed for creating the drug. You can think of this like stocking a factory with parts for building a car. After meeting that goal, we needed to alter the assembly line, to change our E. coli in a way that caused it to create new versions of urethromycin. Our technique was to engineer E. coli to make many forms of the drug with a slightly different shape. Using the factory analogy, this is like building many cars of the same model with different hood ornaments. Our research could lead to new types of antibiotics for fighting infections that don't respond to existing drugs. We look at this as one possible solution to the emerging antibiotic resistance crisis. Our system allows us to engage in a game of molecular chess with harmful bacteria. As they come up with new means to thwart antibiotics, the engineering capabilities we have discovered could enable us to produce new compounds.
That was Blaine Pfeiffer of the University of Buffalo. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And by the way, if you've tried that before and it hasn't worked, we've fixed it. Knowledge@WAMC.org really works now. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.